Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. On Monday's edition of the program, we explored the ongoing impacts of a persistent red tide algae bloom that's been plaguing waters along southwest Florida's Gulf Coast since last fall. The hospital director for the Clinic for the Rehabilitation of Wildlife, or CRO, on Sanibel Island, tells us that the rate of seabirds and sea turtles being treated at their facility has not slowed down since late last October. To date, there has been no proven way to eliminate red tide, particularly in large areas, without causing harm to the natural ecosystem. But now scientists with Moat Marine Laboratory in Sarasota are leading an effort to help reduce the impact of red tide on coastal communities by utilizing filter feeding organisms to sift out Karenia brevis. That's the organism responsible for red tide blooms and the brevetoxins they produce from the water. Joining me now for a closer look at this newly launched research project is one of the scientists leading that effort. Dr. Tracy Finera is a staff scientist and environmental health program manager with Moat Marine Laboratory. She's an engineer with extensive research experience in biology and water quality analysis. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thanks.
And I invite listeners to join our conversation as well. Phone lines are open at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. And Dr. Finera, you know, given that a big focus of Moat's environmental health program includes the organization's beach conditions reporting system, I imagine that few people are quite as acutely aware as you are of the ongoing impacts of red tide here in southwest Florida. So really, before we delve into what this newly launched research effort is all about, can we take a step back and maybe have you explain just exactly what red tide is?
Yes. So red tide is a bloom or an increased population of a phytoplankton called Karenia brevis. So phytoplankton, we get 70% of our oxygen from phytoplankton, but a few of these species are harmful, meaning that they release a toxin that can harm aquatic wildlife. And red tide or Karenia brevis is one of those species. The special thing about this species, though, is that when it releases that toxin, the toxin can actually aerosolize. It attaches onto sea salt particles and moves onshore. So it causes respiratory irritation like coughing or sneezing in people that are healthy, but for those individuals with asthma or COPD or other respiratory illnesses, it can be very serious. So up to this point, the best thing that we can do is monitor, find out where those effects are, and alert the public so that they can make healthy decisions when going to the beach. Red tide blooms are really patchy, so you might have effects at one side of the beach and not another, or at one beach and then another beach just a mile down the road, you can be fine. Like in the case of Venice, you know, you can have effects at North Jetty and not at Nokomis. So.
And what do we know about the impacts of human activity on the manifestation of red tide blooms?
So we have found reports of red tide dating back to the 1500s. The first official report was in the 1800s. It's been around. It's a naturally occurring phenomena, and research, the only scientific evidence of red tide initiation has been at the ocean bottom around the 40-meter isobath in Sarasota, which is 40 miles out. So the thought is that upwelling and currents bring these blooms to the surface, and then winds and currents move them.
Okay, so I think that's good to note. Like, even in a healthy coastal ecosystem, you know, the presence of Karenia brevis, it's going to be there, even if it's just in background concentrations.
You're exactly right. It's always around.
Okay. And I mentioned that southwest Florida has been plagued by this you know, particular bloom or patches of blooms that have persisted since this past fall. You know, and so even though red tide is something, you know, that, you know, longtime southwest Florida residents, well, you mentioned going back to 1500s, it's something we've gotten used to experiencing from time to time. But is it unusual to have a bloom like this persist for this sort of period of time?
Right. That's a great question. And, you know, we've had a bloom every single year except for one year since 86 when NOAA started recording these red tide blooms. So there's always been a bloom. It's just, you know, where it is differs from year to year. Now, this bloom, typically, historically speaking, blooms have started in late summer, early fall, and around winter time. And this one seems to be persisting now into July. I've only started working with red tide in 2015. So this is, and I've been experiencing red tide since I became a Florida resident in 2000. So in my experience, yes, this is extremely long. Now, statistically speaking, is this bloom worse than other blooms? And you really have to look at what you're basing worse on. You know, is it the amount of fish killed? Is it the length of bloom? Is it the intensity of the respiratory irritation? This bloom is the longest one that I've seen.
Gotcha. And as I understand it, there are effective methods out there for mitigating red tide blooms, but they involve the use of harmful chemicals, so they're kind of like those cutting off your nose to spite your face type solutions.
Oh, yeah.
Is that the case?
Oh, yeah. Bleach will kill Karenia brevis, but it'll also kill everything else.
Right.
So they've tried, there's a group that really want to try bleach, and that's very interesting, but there's another group that wanted to try clay, you know, because they thought that clay, well, it's, you know, it's a bio, you know, natural type sediment.
Right.
However, putting that sediment in the ocean was taking out a lot of other species too. In the same way that it was taking out with the same mechanisms that it was reducing Karenia brevis populations, it was doing so to the phytoplankton community and other organisms. So it was doing the same thing without the, you know, toxicity.
Okay. And so now you and a fellow moat scientist, Dr. Vince Lovko, are embarking on this project involving the use of filter feeding organisms to sort of sift out the red tide organism. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, that's fine. Basically, one of our scientists, Dr. Richard Pierce, who has been working with red tide since the 60s, he has focused a lot of his research on the toxicology of food, of human, you know, edible bivalves like clams, mussels, sunray Venus, and to see how long the toxin persists. So in a conversation with a group that was using living docks, that's kind of what they called them, to reduce the turbidity or the cloudiness of the water to make it more clear, and then putting together the research that Dr. Pierce has done, finding that these bivalves accumulate the toxin, meaning that they remove it from the water column, it just made sense to use this as a mitigation strategy for red tide effects in areas that these living docks or mini reefs can be implemented, like canalways or small waterways.
How big are these living docks or mini reefs? I'm trying to paint a mental picture in my head.
Yeah, I can send you a picture, but the ones that we're using right now, first of all, we're doing a lab scale test, so we're only using part of what would be what someone would put in their canal. And the crazy thing is when we went to put out our living docks, which are probably 1 by 2.5 feet and probably about 2.5 feet tall.
Okay.
I'm looking at it right now, trying to estimate. But when we went out to put them out there, it turned out that there was a high school group doing a science experiment on biofouling. So there were already colonized structures, ladders, and they looked like, out in the water. And that's what we're using for our lab scale test. Now, that being said, we thought that these structures that we put out wouldn't colonize in time. And in fact, within a month and a half to 2 months, I mean, they're completely covered. You got to see this. Like, I'm not a biologist. I'm an environmental engineer. And to see these little organisms and how it just grew an entire universe, like, it was just incredible to see all these filter feeders and all these potential mitigators of the red tide species, Karenia brevis.
So the idea for this, at least in the short term, is to, you know, try and get this working, like have people who live on a canal put them out there and then work with small volumes of water. But does this also have potential maybe further down the road to maybe help mitigate the impacts of red tide, say, in Charlotte Harbor or Boca Grande Pass or something like that?
Yes. So that's Boca Grande Pass is on the residential side, on the bay side, is exactly where we're going to start.
Oh, excellent.
With the citizen science project, pending that this works inside the laboratory.
Right. We've got to prove that part first.
Yeah, and the great thing is, like, have you ever seen that YouTube video where you see the oysters in a tank, two dirty tanks. You see the oysters in one tank and no oysters in the other tank. And within an hour, it's clean.
Yes, yes.
So their capacity to filter water is extremely high. And with the way currents work, we're constantly getting new water in these canalways. So some strategies that might remove, you know, the toxin temporarily wouldn't have that kind of capacity to keep on filtering the water, whereas these natural native species do. And we're really hoping to get on that. And there's other possibilities with it, you know, like islands. Like making, have you ever seen those in water quality strategies, floating islands, where a lot of times they use like macroalgae?
Oh, sure, sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or either water hyacinth controlled in some areas to remove metals. There could be possibilities of doing this in, bigger canalways or other water bodies. And then on top of it, we found that a lot of macroalgae was attaching to these structures, and macroalgae actually impedes on red tide blooms, allelopathic way. We don't know exactly what's happening, but we do know that whatever chemical is released is impeding Karenia brevis.
Interesting, great innovative way to use these, naturally occurring organisms that are already out there doing their job, but just in a more focused way.
Right.
Really looking forward to touching base with you a little further down the road to watch the progress of this project. But unfortunately, we are about out of time for today's show. But thank you so
much.
Sorry
for taking up all the time.
No, not at all. Not at all. We've been speaking with Dr. Tracy Fanera. She's a staff scientist and environmental health program manager with Moat Marine Laboratory in Sarasota. And again, thanks so much for spending the time with us. Look forward to touching base with you down the road.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
And thanks to our earlier guests during our segment about the Hometown Teams exhibit at the Alliance for the Arts, Glenn Miller, Yvonne Hill, and J. Webb Horton. Our show today was produced by Mike Canary and myself. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm John Davis. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.